Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I guess it's not. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Fran Lewis, and this is MJ Network. Here's my music. Well, good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, I should say. The snow is still there. It's cold, but the sun is shining, and I am so excited. Two of my favorite authors are here. Well, one is here. Douglas Preston is here. Lincoln Child should be here. We're going to talk about verses for the dead. What happens when a visit to the cemetery for a late husband created a tribute to his memory would change and alter Isabella's life every for the rest. Her obedient dog Twinkle noticed or smelled something, and I'm not going to tell you anymore. Good afternoon. How are you? I'm so glad you're here. I love this book. It was really good.
No, thank you, Fran. It's great to be on the air.
Well, I am totally thrilled. You have no idea. So, you get the first question anyway. Your publicist, Stacy, is absolutely exemplary. She's phenomenal. Got everything candid. So, Pendergast. I did some research. A little bit of research about him. And when creating Pendergast, the reader realizes that he's very austere, reserved, and yet when he's with Constance, he's a different person. He's unemotional, and yet he has a way of hiding his anger. How did you create him and describe his personality? And I love the way he's able to do a number on anyone when he wants to detect their skills. How did you do that? Because that's absolutely brilliant.
Well, thank you. Well, he's a bit of a mysterious character, even to us. The way he was created was when we were writing our first book, Relic, which some of you may know is made into a movie, which unfortunately cut him from the movie. I don't know, that was crazy. But anyway, I wrote the first chapters, and I sent them to Link, and he read them, and he said, oh, these are great, these are wonderful, but you got these two cops, one's Irish and one's Italian, and they're kind of the same character. So what I think we ought to do is we ought to fold these two characters together into one character, and then we ought to have a detective who's totally and utterly unique, like nobody else. And by this time, I was really irritated and annoyed that Lincoln was, you know, criticizing my work. So very sarcastically, I said, oh, yeah, like an albino from New Orleans. And Lincoln said, well, you know, I think we can work with that. You know, let's riff on that. So we started talking, and Pendergast just developed as a character. Now, he's not an albino, but he's very pale. He's austere. Mm-hmm. He wears black. He's a gentleman from the old South. He's in New York. He's a man out of place and out of time. I mean, the New York cops look on him as an absolute freak, but he's, you know, got this ability to deal with people in a very hardcore way, but in a gentlemanly hardcore way that really cuts him off at the knees, but does it very smoothly and very politely and without, you know, ruffling anybody's hair, mussing up any, you know what I mean? So he has this unique ability to sort of get what he wants by the way he speaks to people and what he knows about people and how he is able to suss out a difficult person's, you know, weakness and their, and then, you know, stick the stiletto in and get what he needs.
That's why I like him, because people complain about me all the time that if I want to know something, I'm not going to stop until I get the answer, which is why I think Pendergast is so cool, because he doesn't stop, especially The book opens in a unique way with Isabella, and I love Twinkle, he's so cute, paying their respects to her late husband. And then all of a sudden he realizes that there's something not right. How did you decide to create? That was Link's question, by the way. You get to answer it.
Well, that's
to
all right.
Snap
actually,
off, and
well, how did you come up with that idea?
Yeah, because my newest book is going to be from, I write from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone that did something wrong and got there. So this book was really, you know, right up my alley. So how did you come up with that, the cemetery, and then cutting somebody's heart out? That is so cool.
Oh, God. Well, it was just so sick, you know. I mean, that was Link's idea, you know. He looks nice on the surface, but underneath there's a real sickness there. But we decided, you know, we studied cases of real serial killers. You know, we try to do our research. We don't make stuff up when we can actually find something much weirder in reality. So one of the characteristics of a certain type of serial killer is they take body parts from the victim as kind of a souvenir. And there was, in fact, a serial killer who cut the hearts out of his victims. So we had this idea, and then it was Lincoln's idea that this killer leaves the hearts on the graves of other people, especially women who have committed suicide 10, 11 years before, with a note of condolence. So the opening scene of Verses for the Dead is this lady visiting her husband's grave, and she brings a little dog with her, and the dog finds his heart and grabs it and runs off to eat it. So she's chasing after the dog, not understanding what's going on. And so it's a pretty horrible, gruesome, and darkly comic scene. But that's how it begins. And that was all Lincoln. Believe me, not me. That's him.
Absolutely, yeah, I would think of something like that, too. It's scary. Oh, my God, was that good, though. So we've got Felicia Montero. I've got my questions in front of me, so I don't forget. Elise Baker, suicide. Angela, suicide. Jerry Rosen is dead after going to a bar with some friends. This is one of the issues that I really find as an educator and as somebody that, you know, young person, that, you know, people that go to bars, they got to be careful when you go to a bar that you don't, if you leave your drink there, don't take it back. Take it, get a different one, because you never know what's going to happen. And that was scary. So you left, they left. How did you choose, I know these girls are dead, and they need to know, young people need to know what to go to a bar, but why did you choose T.S. Eliot, Romeo and Juliet, which I love, Faust, and other pieces of literature? How did you decide on the saying that you left at the grave? That was really cool.
Well, the serial killer fancies himself a literary man. And he calls himself Mr. Broken Hearts. You know, which is, of course, an allusion to Miss Lonely Hearts, which was a famous novel of the 1930s. And, in fact, that novel does have a connection to what he's doing today. But anyway, so he fancies himself a literary person. So in these notes of condolence, he has some literary quote from Shakespeare, from T.S. Eliot, actually from contemporary novelist Ian McEwan, that sort of thing. And that's part of who he is. It's part of his character. One thing that is strange about this book, perhaps, and I'm almost afraid to say this, but most serial killers have you have no sympathy for them. They're just the most horrible, sick people. But this serial killer, we wanted to create a serial killer who would, in the end, arouse a certain level of sympathy in the readership, who have an insight into who he is, why he's doing what he's doing, and what happened to him as a child that made him feel like he had to do these things. So it's really, we tried to create a more complex and nuanced portrait of a serial killer instead of just this terrifying bad guy like, The Silence of the Lambs, which is a fantastic book. But, you know, the serial killer in there, James Gum, is so damn crazy and bizarre, and he's just, there's no redeeming qualities. Whereas our serial killer, in the end, I don't want to give away the end of the book, but, you know, we understand him, even if we are still horrified at what he does.
Yeah, well, the ending was unique, I'll tell you that. And nobody's going to expect the way it ended, but, you know, Pendergast is great. What can I say? But this scene really got me. I read it like four times, and I go, what? He's thrown a definite curveball when he's invited to meet who doesn't like him. I don't know why. The new assistant deputy in charge of this section in a sauna. Now, this was hilarious because he was dressed in a suit and everybody else is ready to, you know, be in the sauna. He sits off to the side and then he has a partner. And I go like, are you kidding me? Why doesn't he doesn't even get outraged. So how come you decided on a partner and Coleman? I really like that character, by the way. And the reason he was given the assignment, I mean, they worked very well together. That was interesting. So how come you guys decided on that? Because that was cool.
Well, thank you. Well, Pendergast is a bit of a rogue agent in the FBI. He doesn't play by the rules. And a lot of his perps end up dead. They don't go to trial. And this is not something the FBI likes. You know, they like a nice, neat case. They like the perp to be alive, to go to trial, to be convicted, etc. So Pendergast, they decide, and the New York office are going to rein him in and give him a partner. And a new deputy director comes in who decides on a power play with Pendergast, going to summon him to the sauna. And in the sauna, he's going to drop the bombshell that Pendergast from now on is going to have a partner. Well, Pendergast, you know, who's very experienced with power plays like this, shows up in the sauna. He walks through the dressing room in his black suit. People are saying, hey, you can't go in there. You got to, you know, he walks right past everybody, you know, and he walks right into the sauna with his suit. Greets the deputy director, sits down, and the deputy director is like, "Well, wait a minute, you're broken all the rules. You're not supposed to be in a suit." And he said, "Well, I enjoy the heat." So then, so Pendergast has already put the poor deputy director on the defensive. So it proceeds from there. So the deputy director then introduces him to Cold Moon, his new partner. And immediately there, Pendergast is very suspicious of this Cold Moon character. Who is he? I mean, you know, and does not appreciate having a partner and understands right away that this guy is sort of a babysitter for him. Although he's the junior partner, Pendergast is a senior partner, still Cold Moon is sort of his babysitter. So he flies down to Florida to the crime scene without Cold Moon. He arrives a day early. You know, he gets on the plane right away. He's supposed to wait for Cold Moon and go down the next morning. So already he's one up Cold Moon. But Cold Moon turns out to be pretty, you know, he's very different from Pendergast. He comes from a very different background. You know, Pendergast comes from a very wealthy, southern, you know, upper class background. Cold Moon comes from a really hard scrabble background in North Dakota, where he's half Lakota and half Italian. So he really pulled himself up by his bootstraps. So these two characters, in a weird way, start to relate to each other. They start to understand each other, and it proceeds from there.
I love his name, Cold Moon. That was really good. Sort of. It's what it says, I think. But,
yeah, and his Italian name is Esposito.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So he's got both sides, you know.
He certainly does. So we go to the first crime scene. I read this twice. I was hysterical laughing. He goes over and he sees this officer who's not going to let him go through. But he manages to destroy him by letting him know he knows all about him and he better not even know if he's going to let the bag out about his life and cheating on his wife. So how did you decide that? That was hilarious.
Well, we took a page from Sherlock Holmes. I have to
okay.
I'll admit that. You know, one of the best things about Sherlock Holmes is someone comes into
him.
his office and he can tell from all these clues on the person, the mud on the boots, the this, the that, you know, all he can deduce all these characteristics of the person, seems to know a lot about him. So Pendergast, so the FBI has a really difficult relationship with the Miami Beach Police Department. They've been some difficulties there. So Pendergast shows up early, does not have authorization. This cop is there, really recalcitrant, and says, look, without the authorization, I'm not going to let you into the crime scene. And so Pendergast, by looking at this cop who and looking at the clues on him, just picking it up, is able to deduce a whole bunch of things about him. He's cheating on his wife. He has a drinking problem, and various other things. And so he's able to threaten the cop with all this information, and the cop, horrified, you know, and beaten down by this, you know, lets him into the crime scene. You know, so it's kind of an interesting, it's a bit of a Sherlock Holmes style scene.
Without a doubt, it's like, oh my God, he's almost like clairvoyant. Like, okay.
But it's all done very scientifically. He explains how he knows these things.
Yeah,
you
know.
It seems like he's clairvoyant, but then when he explains, well, you know, well, I don't want to bore your listeners with the whole story, but it's kind of clever how he's able to figure out. He even is able to figure out what kind of liquor this cop is drinks habitually. So
I looked up something about his memory, and he looks at things in four different ways. And I'm saying, yeah, you know, if more people did that, maybe the police would solve crimes a lot faster. You never know. So he's got a touch of Adrian Monk, who I love, a little bit of Perrault, but he's really about himself. And he delivers the truth. So you had to did you do any research into autopsies and how they proceed? Because poor Coldman almost passed out every single time. He had to go before the ME, and I don't know how many people could deal with that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Well, autopsies figure in our novels, have figured before, and so I've witnessed an autopsy. Actually, there are videos online. There are other things you can see. There's a lot of research you can do on how exactly an autopsy is conducted, especially with a body that's been maybe buried for 11 years. You know, there's a different way of working than when you're working with a person who's recently deceased. So yeah, so we did a lot of research, but it's pretty tough. I mean, the first time you see an autopsy, it's awful. You know, you really have to disassociate yourself from it. You have to kind of numb yourself to what you're looking at because it's terrible to see a human being cut up and have the organs taken out and weighed and everything. And the face peeled back. I mean, it's not easy. But like anything, you can get used to it.
I know what you're saying. I mean, I had enough trouble watching my mom in California with a hospital where they took out her heart, and then they said, would you like to come in and witness any of it afterwards? I said, I'll wait till afterwards. I was like, okay.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
yeah.
Dear. Jeez.
Yeah. It was scary. She had a pulmonary thrombectomy. Her whole chest was black. And they did this whole MIC thing, and they said after 24 hours, whatever, I could go in and just stay there as long as I wanted. They actually put me to work and taught me how to read the machines. And it was a learning experience. And they said, do you want to learn how to do the ventilator? I said, no, I don't think so. I don't want to do something that would hurt her. But I did learn a lot. But, yeah, I don't think I could watch somebody's brain being cut up. No, not really. So
yeah.
Who are the different officials or officers that aided in a quest to find the killer? Because every organization, I mean, I've read, seriously, my husband counted about 9,000 books in the last 10 years that I've been doing this. And it's scary, yeah. It's my mother's fault. She made me read.
It's wonderful. You're a reader. You're a rare person in this world. So an author, I have to say thank you.
I love reading your book, and actually when you read my review, you can actually tell I read it. That you can tell from my questions, I read it, yeah.
Yes.
I was told by John Land to say hi to you and Dick Belsky because they were on my panel show on Monday. We talked about dialogue,
okay.
And I specifically told them that you were going to be on. Yeah, they're amazing, but they complain because I always get what their books are about, and sometimes I pick out things that they don't even know. It's scary. But who are the people that aid in an inquest because sometimes I read books that where the inquest just doesn't make sense or the crime scene, the person doesn't know what they're doing. So how did you create the notes that the reporter receives, and who are the people that are allowed to be part of this? Because yours, of course, was accurate, but I read so many that I go like, are you kidding me?
Well, it's an interesting thing because, you know, every area of the country, every county, every city has a slightly different way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, New York City has a medical examiner who's an extremely prominent and even famous person who has who's an MD and often advanced degrees and really, you know, highly trained person with a whole staff underneath him of very highly trained person, you know, forensic pathologists and very, you know, number of disciplines. And then you go to some rural county in Georgia and you have a county coroner who's a person who may not even have a degree. He's just some guy who maybe took a training course. And so there's a huge difference in experience. Now, my brother's a doctor in rural Maine.
Wow.
And so I learned a lot of things from him about how these things happen. For example, you know, when people die, it's very rare that someone will receive an autopsy. And and a private autopsy costs $15,000. So it's only when there's a real suspicion of wrongdoing or when the family is really insistent and is willing to pay, is there an autopsy. Autopsies are very rare, actually. They're very expensive. So you know, in a small town, you get some very inexperienced a county coroner who's doesn't really know what he's doing and, you know, overlooks things. And then in a bigger city like Miami, where this book takes place, you have very sophisticated people with sub-disciplines doing the work. So in the novel, Verses for the Dead, what happened here is that there's a number of women who've committed suicide 10 or 11 years ago that this man is putting the hearts on the grave of these women, on the graves of these women. So the question is, do these women have anything in common? So Pendergast wants to reevaluate the pathologist reports from these women who committed suicide. And, you know, some of them are more sophisticated than others. Some of them were very poorly done, missed everything. Others are more sophisticated and more accurately done. But in most instances, Pendergast wants to re-exhume the corpse to really examine what happened to these women to make sure, you know, was it really suicide? Did they really commit suicide in this particular manner? Or what's really going on? And, of course, you know, the things are never as they seem.
No, nothing's ever the way they seem. I mean, the other thing I learned during all this is that the media can either destroy you or really help you. So would a reporter like in this story go to that extent to solve a case and get noticed? And just how dangerous can their strategies and the media be in a case like this or any kind of case that they have?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we have a reporter in the story who's a very ambitious guy. And he, you know, reporters, there are different kinds of reporters. There are some who really step over the line and actually try to, if it's an unsolved murder case, they're actually trying to solve the case. They're actually doing original research or, you know, investigation. And this guy goes out very foolishly and decides to interview a guy he thinks might be the killer. Now, that actually is based on my own personal experience as a journalist, where I with a writing partner. We were investigating a case of a serial killer, and we thought we had identified the person. This is an unsolved case. And we went to him, and we interviewed him. And at the end of the interview, we asked him, "Are you the Monster of Florence?" which was the name of the serial killer. And that was a pretty foolish thing to do. But
yeah.
When the police when the police investigation has gone completely awry, and they're way off in left field, and they're hopelessly lost, sometimes you, as a journalist, you feel you have to do this. Now, I was writing an article for the New Yorker magazine at the time, and my editor at the New Yorker said to me, "You have to interview this guy, and you have to ask him if he's the Monster of Florence." And I was like, "Well, he's a serial killer." I mean, she said, "Well, so what?" She said, "We have reporters out in the field being shot at in war zones. I mean, you know, what, are you afraid to ask a little serial killer if he's a serial killer? I mean, you go and ask him." And you get his answer, and you put that in the article. So
she didn't have to sit in front of him. Oh, my God. Actually, I don't know if I could do something like that, but I've been pretty brazen to ask a lot of questions, but I don't know. Was this guy in prison at the time, behind bars, I hope?
No, he was not. He was not. He had been peripherally involved in the case and had been kind of a suspect, but only peripherally, but never, nothing was ever proven. No, he was free. And the investigation
had
moved on from him into a kind of a way out there territory. So, but this was also in Italy. I used to live in Florence, and this was a case that involved a serial killer who murdered young lovers in the Tuscan Hills around Florence in the 70s and 80s and had never been caught. So I was working with an Italian journalist, and so this was all in Italian. And I knew that if worse came to worse, I could get on a plane and fly back to America, and he couldn't follow me. So, you know, I could escape, but my writing partner could not, because he lived in the territory that the Monster of Florence lived in. So he was really worried.
I would be worried, too. Oh, my God. I would have taken a bodyguard. Actually, men would have worn a mask so he couldn't see me.
Well, Mario Spezzi, my writing partner, did use a fake name for the interview.
He should have used a fake face,
which you're not supposed
too.
To do, is it? Yeah, exactly. Well, he couldn't fake his face, but he used a fake name. It didn't work because the person we interviewed looked at him and said, "Oh, I must have misheard your name. You're Mario Spezzi. You're the guy who wrote all those articles about the Monster of Florence. I've read everything you've written."
Oh, my God. That would have given me the creeps, too. So we have another character that wasn't my favorite, though. Captain Grove. Why is he so helpful to Pendergast? I put a question mark over him when I was writing my review, which I posted the day the book came out. By the way, people, this book came out December 31st, but we're going to call it one of the best books for 2018 and 19. We're just going to move it right up. That's it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, the interesting thing about Commander. Thank you. Well, the interesting thing about Commander Grove is that he is helping Pendergast for maybe 2/3 of the book with no idea where Pendergast's investigation is going to lead, and he actually has no idea that Pendergast's investigation is going to turn around and eventually threaten him. So he's genuinely helpful. He thinks this is a really interesting case. He's able to help Pendergast tremendously with it. He helps him along. The irony of this is very thick. And then at a certain point, he wakes up and he thinks, "Holy moly. Oh, my God, now I understand what's going on with this case." He didn't understand before. He didn't understand who the serial killer was or what he was doing. And when he realizes what's happening and he suddenly realizes, uh-oh, this is going to come back to me. And so he then turns very invisibly to try to frustrate the investigation, to try to stop it. And I don't want to tell any more than that because I don't want to give anything away,
no.
But it's it's kind of interesting. His help for two-thirds of the book is totally genuine. He's really, really wants to catch the serial killer. He really wants to help. He's really involved. And then all of a sudden he realized, oh, my God, if they catch the serial killer, my goose is cooked. The last thing I want is for them to catch the serial killer.
That's really scary. I know. I often wonder how many police departments really want to solve the case or not. I mean, right near where I used to live, we had the Son of Sam right there.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, I know.
It was scary.
That case. Yeah.
And I had black hair, so I used to wear, you know, a blonde wig over it because I didn't want anybody. And he worked in the post office. That wasn't too far away. I was like, oh, my God, David Berkowitz. That's just what we don't need. But, you know,
so
you don't know. You never know who anybody is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about a serial killer. That's very surprising, and it's something that surprised me. When we interviewed this man we thought was the monster of Florence, and I still think he is. He's still out there.
Okay.
The police have not...
Oh, God, that's even better.
...done anything, but I was expecting a weird person, strange, you know, kind of, you know, bizarre, you know, person who gives you the creeps. But that wasn't what happened at all. Guy was very handsome. He was very good looking.
Mm.
He was very self-assured. He was very arrogant. He said, come in, sit down, have a glass of Mirtillo, which is this Sardinian liqueur, you know, very, you know, and smiling all the time, very good looking and charming in kind of a rough working class way, kind of like a young Robert De Niro type, you know.
Oh,
and even as our questioning got closer and closer to him, and he realized that we were questioning him as if he were the monster of Florence, he never stopped smiling and he never stopped this kind of arrogant, superior air, even to the very end when we asked him, are you the monster of Florence? And his answer was horrible, which I can't repeat on the air because it's so grotesque and misogynistic, but he was still smiling when he said it.
Would scare me. I mean, I've had people look at you and look at me and look at other people and smile at you, and you know that they're guilty. So talk about Fourchette, the medical examiner. Why was she better than her boss?
Well, the medical, this is interesting. The medical examiner in this area is, again, you have a very prominent person who runs the Office of the Medical Examiner. And in this case, we thought, let's have an arrogant jerk running the office. Because in a curious way, some medical examiners really are very arrogant. I mean, they're like surgeons.
I know.
You know, they're prominent. They think they're wonderful, and sometimes they are wonderful. But this guy's not wonderful. He's one of these jackasses who's, you know, full of himself and everything else. And he has this young... pathologist, you know, who's an assistant to him, up and coming, and he treats her abominably, you know, condescendingly. I mean, she's a woman, she's African American. He kind of implies that her hiring was affirmative action, you know, kind of thing. I mean, really offensive. Treats her offensively, but she's actually a much better pathologist than he is, and so Pendergast immediately has an affinity for this younger woman and can't stand this arrogant guy who's head of the office, and at a certain point cuts this guy off at the knees because he's really tired of him. And this young pathologist then actually makes some discoveries that are really important, which help solve the case.
Well, Pendergast is really very quiet and private. So how come, and this was really priceless, how come he agreed to do an on-air live interview, which a lot of people wouldn't do if they were Pendergast? How did you decide that he was actually going to get on the air and destroy somebody? I loved it. It was really good.
Well, thank you. He had a hidden agenda there. So there's this like Fox News type anchor who keeps bugging him, wants him to get on the air to talk about this sensational case, which is freaking out Miami. And Pendergast agrees to go on the air, which is very, as you say, very unlike him. But when he gets on the air, instead of answering her questions and, you know, talking about the case, he stands up, he turns to the camera, he walks to the camera, and he speaks directly to the serial killer. Now, this is not something we made up. This actually happened years ago with an investigator who was investigating a really crazy serial killer. And he went on TV, and he did the same thing. He stood up, and he walked up to the TV, to the camera, and he addressed the serial killer directly and said, and then, you know, asked him questions and said, this is what we know about you. This is what we're going to do. You know, you need to give yourself up. And he made a plea. So Pendergast addresses the serial killer directly, but he knows the serial killer's philosophy. He knows his mentality. And so what he says to the killer freaks the killer out and at least temporarily stops him from killing and actually leads to a breakthrough in the case where they finally solve the case. So, but of course, the television people are freaking out. Now, the anchor is very upset because the attention is drawn from her. But the producer is like, no, no, this is great television. Keep the cameras rolling. Keep them rolling. You know, I've been on many television shows, and, you know, you have an anchor, and then you have a producer who's behind the scenes, who's, like, really running the show. So in this case, the producer's like, the anchor's, like, gesturing to cut away from Pendergast back to her, because she doesn't want the camera on him. And the producer's like, no, keep the cameras on him. This is awesome television. So all of Miami watches this show, and they're all just divided. Half of them think it's terrible that this cop was speaking to Pendergast in such a, that Pendergast was speaking to the serial killer in such a sympathetic way, and then the other half are like amazed at this kind of amazing show. So.
Well, it's almost like some of the police shows that you see on television, or some of the other shows that are not so accurate too. But this is accurate. My God.
Well, we try to be accurate.
You are, because I have to tell you very honestly, I'm a reading and writing staff developer, but I love doing research. And when it's historical, or there's something that has to do with history, or even autopsies, or even anything that requires to make sure that it's accurate, Fran looks it up all the time.
Good.
It's fun, and like I said before, my mother made me read 10 books a week and take notes on them. I still do it. So that if you ever really saw Verses for the Dead, you wouldn't be able to read it, because I underlined, circled, and wrote notes inside the book to tell me what I wanted to ask and what I would include in my book review, seriously. And I have to seriously thank Stacy for just sending it. It was one of those, you know, I get books a lot. I have about 20 on my chair right now, and they just show up. And when this one showed up, I got all excited. And then when she said you wanted to do the interview, I was even more excited. And there are an awful lot of people that want to read this book, and I told them they have to go to Amazon to get it, because I'm not giving them the book. No.
No. Well, thank you.
I'm very popular with people. Everybody, you know, wants everything. Okay, so the ending is really scary. And we have Felice, Mary, Abernathy, Baxter Flake, and all the rest of them. Some of them were one thing, and some of them were something else. So how did you create the pattern of death and lead to Pendergast realizing whether they were suicides or whether they weren't, or whatever they were? Because that was really fantastic, because I said, like, he's going to get this. I know he's going to get it.
Well, all of our novels really have a surprise at the end or a twist.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you get to the end, you're surprised, you're astonished. But at the same time, you say, oh, God, I should have seen that coming. I see, you know, it isn't something out of left field. So in the end of Verses for the Dead, all the secrets are revealed. Why this man was killing. Why he was placing the hearts on the graves of those particular suicide victims,
mm-hmm.
how those suicide victims are linked, even though they don't seem to be because they're committing suicide all over the country. And so everything comes into focus. And a big surprise is who the real bad guy is. It turns out the truly evil person is not actually the serial killer, although he's sick and evil himself, but is another person entirely. So there's a lot of surprises. And, of course, at the end, there's also a lot of Pendergast almost, you know, buys the farm, so to speak, you know, in uncovering the truth.
Yeah.
He is put in great danger, he and his partner.
You can't kill him off. You can't kill him off. But question that's not on my page before I get to the ones that are on my page, would he ever move up to a higher position, like director or like this other guy that, you know, is running the thing? Would you ever move him up where he has more of a place of authority, or doesn't he want that?
It's probably unlikely that he would move up because he's too much of a rogue agent. You know, he gets himself in trouble just often enough that promotion is not going to be offered to him. Also, he's not a team player. And when you move up the ranks of an organization like the FBI, you really have to be a team player. You have to, you know, be someone who gets along with others. Pendergast does not get along well with others, or some others anyway. He especially does not get along in a bureaucratic environment, which the FBI does have its bureaucracy. I mean, I have a friend who's, you know, we know FBI agents, and I remember this one friend of mine who's an FBI agent saying to me, you know, I love your character, Pendergast, but how come you never show him doing the paperwork? He says, I spend 2 days a week doing paperwork. And I say, well, you know, yeah, I mean, you're right. Pendergast should be shown 2 days a week doing the paperwork. But who's going to want to read about that?
Not really. It wouldn't fit his character, I don't think, to sit at a desk. Maybe Coldmoon, but definitely not him. But before I forget, Monday at 10 o'clock a.m., the author of Free Fall, Jessica Barry from England. It should be interesting. That was an interesting novel that was sent to me, and it was a surprise, too. On the 21st, A Crystal King, the story about Bartholomew Scappi, a real Italian chef, and she sort of put it in as if he's alive today. It was really interesting, too. On the 25th, the author of Dark Paradise. On the 26th, someone that you know, David Putnam, The Reckless, and that book is really good. And the 28th, what better way to end the month than with playwright, actor, songwriter, screenplay editor, writes for TV Land and has his own station on radio, Herbie Pilato, Mary Tyler Moore, The Mary Tyler Moore Story. And we're going to do a tribute to her life on that Thursday. So that's just what's coming up. And then, of course, there's always next month with You Never Know What's Going to Hit Me. So how did you decide where the final scenes would take place, and where do you see Pendergast next? Are you going to bring him back with Cold Moon? Because I like them.
Well, thank you. We are going to bring Cold Moon back, yes.
Oh, good.
You know,
thank God. I was worried.
But you asked a good question about the final scenes in the novel. You know, Lincoln and I do our research. We know that even if a reader hasn't been somewhere, they can tell if you've been there or not. So Lincoln and I did a road trip down Alligator Alley, deep into the Everglades. There's this road that goes out, crosses the Everglades, and goes through all these weird little towns called Alligator Alley. So we drove down this road. We went through the Everglades. We stopped in these towns. We went off on some of the little side roads going off into the swamp. And boy, I've never seen so many alligators in my life. Huge alligators, heaped one on top of the other. And so the final part of the novel is set in the Everglades, in this area, a few miles from one of these really kind of dying, you know, these towns sort of sprung up in the Everglades, supposedly resort towns, but they never made it. A lot of these towns have unfinished real buildings, real estate that never got finished because they went bankrupt, and so they're like half-built houses being overgrown with vines and things. I mean, it's pretty pretty interesting stuff, and the people who do live there are definitely, you know, like swamp type people, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, guys who with airboats who go out, you know, hunting gators and that sort of thing. So that's what we did. So we did that research, and the final part of the book takes place in this really interesting and humid, wet, crazy environment with lots of alligators. Hungry alligators.
I could tell, and I got really nervous. I go, oh, my God, is this other guy's going to get eaten? Or is anybody going to get eaten?
It's an abandoned alligator farm, so there are a lot more alligators there than there used than you'd normally find, mm-hmm. and because the farm has been abandoned, as the, you know, the alligators are, you know, they're kind of hungry.
Well, I'll have to tell you, the reptile house in the zoo is still my favorite. I don't want to go near them, but yeah, the reptile house. I don't know why. I think they're really so cool. And they have snakes and alligators and whatever, but most people don't like to go in there. So, strange question at the end. What would he say if Pendergast could talk to our listeners? What would he say about his partner if he spoke to him, if he spoke to everybody? What would he say about Cold Moon? And what would Cold Moon say about him if they could, you know, speak about each other in person for real?
Well, Cold Moon... and Pendergast, but especially Cold Moon, mm-hmm. has a very strong sense of mm-hmm. his partner.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where things, you know, got tense, because Cold Moon was sort of
mm-hmm.
told, you know, you got to keep track of Pendergast. You got to keep him from going off the rails. But Cold Moon is very loyal to his partner. This is one of his ethical, you know, something that's part of his ethics, or your loyalty to your partner. And that is in conflict with this idea that he's supposed to be a tattletale on his partner.
Yeah.
So Cold Moon refuses to cooperate. And this, of course, pisses off the deputy director a lot, you know. And so Cold Moon says, you know, I'm with my partner, even when he thinks Pendergast is crazy and going off the rails, he still says, I'm with my partner. And Pendergast realizes that and really appreciates it. He understands that Cold Moon has made a choice to be with his partner and support his partner rather than reporting back to the deputy director and of all the things that Pendergast is doing that he thinks are wrong. So Pendergast really appreciates that, and that's when the two of them start to bond in a weird way, because they're so different. I mean, you know, Pendergast, I mean, Cold Moon drinks this horrible acidic coffee, you know, this camp coffee.
Ew.
Pendergast can't stand the smell of it. And Cold Moon is a slob, and Pendergast is a very neat person. And they have to share these scummy motel rooms. And
mm-hmm.
Cold Moon leaves all his crap on Pendergast's bed. And Pendergast, you know, has to deal with that. So there's, you know, certain things about this partnership that are not, that don't work well.
It's almost like the Odd Couple, Phyllis and Oscar, from the Odd Couple, from a long time ago.
That's a good analogy. I like that. I hadn't thought of that, but I think it's very much like that. You know, Oscar is one of my favorite characters
all.
He's just, I love him, both in the television show and in the movie. And I'd say Cold Moon is, he's like Oscar, except he's a more reticent. He's more, he doesn't talk as much. He's quieter, but has a similar kind of slobbiness.
Yeah, but you know, being too neat is no fun. My sister was OCD and very neat. And then there's me, in between somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm a perfectionist,
yeah.
but not when that, you know, I can't be bothered sometimes. So... I was very careful, being very honest. I know the killer's name is Mr. Brokenheart, but when I wrote my review, I didn't reveal his name. Then when I posted my review, I said, everybody told who he is. I was really careful because I didn't want people to know who it was. I try to keep, you know, no spoilers. I said, well, you want to know who the name of the killer is, you're going to have to read the book. So if the killer could speak to the listeners, would he ask them forgiveness? Is he sorry? Would he be sorry? Or would he do it again? this guy. He was really good, let me tell you.
He would be sorry. He would be sorry. He's really, really messed up person. And
we know.
He's crazy, but deeply injured mentally and physically, especially mentally.
Mm.
So
yeah.
From to the extent that he can understand what he was doing at all, he is sorry.
Mm.
In fact, the whole motivation behind his killing was to atone for something.
Yeah.
Atonement. And so he's not a classic psychopath who, you know, a classic psychopath feels no empathy, has no sense of compassion, has no way to relate to the feelings of others. Other people are like objects to him to be manipulated. This killer, Mr. Brokenheart, has empathy, has compassion, has sympathy. He just doesn't know. He's expressing it in the craziest way possible.
Well, if you want to read a book about three killers that have no empathy, John Land's book is coming out April 23rd, Strongest Steel. I'm reading it again. Oh, my God. This is unbelievable. I mean, I get everything. But that's interesting. And if you want a thriller, Lee Goldberg's new book is coming out. I just read that, too. And James Grappando's book is coming out next week. I read that in a day. Your book I read in a day, too. It depends.
John Land is one of my favorite writers. He's great. I mean, if your listeners are listening, you're looking for a good writer, pick up John Land. He's an outstanding writer. Yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And the only reason why I'm invited to the Thriller Fest is because he loves me. So I get to come every year. I get to come every year because I review books. And ladies and gentlemen, and Amazon, Fran doesn't charge for book reviews ever. I don't charge for my radio show, and I just do this because it's fun. I really like doing it. And reading is very important, and kids need to learn to read more. And I really wish that everyone would pick up a book. And I don't read Kindle, and I don't read PDF. If it's not, the book is in front of me, I'm not going to read it. I need the print. So we realize that this killer has much to atone for. And yet we realize within the person, like you said, he's got a heart of gold. So my favorite one was City of No Lights. I really loved that. And I didn't know I was getting that one either. It just came and it was a surprise, which is good. This was a surprise too. Did you ever bring back a villain in one of your books? Because there were a lot of, John just brought somebody back. And he doesn't know that I know it, but I know he brought somebody back that was really evil. But did you ever bring back a killer? Did a killer ever get out?
Well, that's a good question. Let me think about that. I don't think we have brought back a killer, although we are going to be bringing back a really nasty character from City of Endless Night into the next Pendergast book we're writing. She was the fixer of the main character who was evil. And she was evil too, but she survived. Mm-hmm. He didn't. She survived to live another day, and she's coming back in the next Pendergast novel.
Oh, that makes me so much happier. When is that coming back so I know when to ask for it? I'm not going to ask. I just hope Stacy just sends it. That would be really good.
Well, she probably will because you're on the list. Probably in March. March of 2020.
Even better. February is gone. March is totally gone this year. So now that we know what's next, are you doing any independent ones, single ones? And is Link doing anything by yourself?
No,
without him?
No, we're both working just together for now. We have a three-book contract that we're fulfilling, or a four-book contract, I can't remember, but we have to fulfill that contract. We have, however, just written a short story, which we're going to give away to our readers. And we're going to give it away. It's a big story. It's almost a novella. But it's going to be free, but you just have to be a subscriber to our newsletter, that's all. And then you get it.
Well, I am now.
Well, good. Well,
I did, but
to subscribe, they can go to our Facebook page, Preston and Child,
uh-huh.
and just click on the little button there, and then you can sign up for the newsletter. It's free.
That is great. So would you, Link, if he decides to come on again ever, do a panel show on main characters or villains? Or I just did one on dialogue, and in April with five people, I brave it every time I do this, we're going to talk about setting, but not where the story takes place, but mostly if the setting drives the plot, or if it destroys the plot, or if there's too much setting, or how does the plot fit into where the story takes place, and whatever other odd questions I can come up with that, you know, nobody else is going to ask. So I do those like twice or three times a year. And for those of you that don't know it, MJ Magazine, which is in the memory of my sister, MJ Magazine came out 2 weeks ago, and I am very proud to say that it's doing okay. I'd like it to do even better. If anybody wants to read it, it's on Amazon. It's writers of all ages. I've had children that wrote book reviews that are fantastic. My nephew Jake wrote one on electronics in the classroom, and a whole bunch of people wrote different articles, and it's writers from ages 5 to 90, something like that. Yeah. So I'm very proud of that. And Silent Voices is my next one coming out. I don't know when. It's told from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone. Either somebody did something really wrong and belongs there, or somebody got there by somebody else's actions. And it's being re-edited because I was given some phenomenal feedback by some phenomenal people. So where can everybody find out about you and Link and Pendergast and all of your books? Because I'm glad I'm on the list. Thank goodness.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have a Facebook page, Preston and Child, which we where we often post. We also have that newsletter I mentioned to you. That's where we get the really good stuff. We only send out one a month. Not going to flood your inbox with newsletters, but generally we give away stuff. And like I said, we're going to have a free short story illustrated, a novella that's just going to be free to anyone who is a newsletter subscriber. And then I also have an Instagram account, which is DouglasPreston6, so where I sometimes post things regarding our books and that sort of thing.
I'll find it. By some place to find it, I will find it. But I want to thank you so much. This was really fun. And I want to thank Stacy personally for sending me the book and having you doing this interview. I just hope Link is okay. I don't know what happened, and she doesn't. I don't know if she was able to get in touch with him. I'm not sure exactly where he is as far as, time zones or something like that.
He's in Florida, but he's a bit absent-minded. He might have just, who knows.
Forgotten.
I love talking to you. You asked really good questions. You're a wonderful interviewer. So I think it went well.
It did. It's fantastic, and I really enjoyed myself, and I think I've told the whole world that you were coming on my show because I was so excited. As a matter of fact, I told my nephew who's in college, and he said, "Oh, my God, I actually know who that is." I go, "That's improvement. I'm glad to hear you know who it is." So I want to thank you, Douglas Preston. Thank you very, very much, and I want to thank Stacy, and I hope Link, gets his memory back and remembers next time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everybody have a great day. The sun is shining. It's freezing here. I don't know how it is where you are, but it's really cold here. It's like, 39 degrees, and that's hot compared to was -2 yesterday. Everybody have a nice day. Thank you so much, Douglas. Everybody, and bye.
Thank you.